When people talk about those events in Gallipoli and France, they sometimes talk about the lost generation. 60,000 Australians died in World War One, and it's always been understood that among them there must have been some extraordinary men, artists, scientists and leaders who signed up, got on a boat to the other side of the world, and who died in battle or from disease. But the phrase, the lost generations, can sound a bit abstract unless you can connect it with the lives of real people, and that's just what Ross McMullen has done. Ross is an historian. He's written about many things, but he keeps returning to Australia in the First World War, or the Great War, as it was called, of 1914 to 1918. Ross has uncovered the stories of 10 Australians of extraordinary ability, and their stories have, until now, been mostly lost to us. These men include an internationally acclaimed medical researcher, an engineer from the heroic age of Antarctic exploration who went there with Mawson, an architect, a winemaker, footballers, and a WA Rhodes Scholar who was assured of a great future in law or politics. Of course, the loss of any of the men who died there, gifted or not, is the same for the people who love them. But the death of these men in particular was a loss to the world and a terrible wound to what had been an optimistic young nation. And the thing that really drives me mad when I've been reading about this is that so many of these lives were lost in operations that were pointless, poorly conceived, and maintained after all hope of success had been lost. Ross McMullen's book is called Farewell, Dear People, Biographies of Australia's Lost Generation. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Richard.
You've written a few books on Australia in World War One. Why do you keep returning to it, Ross?
Well, I think it's the big event of the 20th century. So much of its influence extended through the decades. World War II was really only the unfinished business of World War One, and this was especially the case for Australia, I think, because meaning the extended influence of World War One, because I think we embraced it as a cause so fervently early in the war that when it wasn't over by Christmas, and as you say, 60,000 men died, the crushing disillusionment was all the stronger, I think, in Australia.
60,000 out of an overall population of what, 5 million in Australia in those days?
Not quite 5 million, yes. So it's a crushing loss, calamitous for Australia.
Calamitous. There seems to be more to it than that for you, though, because you write about these men with such affection, and it's really so heartfelt. There seems to be quite an emotional connection for you to this war. What do you think is the basis of that?
Well, perhaps because Australia was carving out for itself a fresh new society just before World War One, and I think the fact that that was smashed was by the war was very telling. Again, had long-term consequences. We pioneered all sorts of social advances in this country leading up to World War One.
Votes for women us and the Kiwis women, did that, didn't we? Yeah.
Votes for women was right up there. All sorts of social advances, the basic wage, the first Labor government in the world was in Queensland in 1899, only for a week, but it was in Australia.
Am I right in thinking we had something like the highest per capita head standard of living in the world back at that time, before the war?
That was the claim that was made, yes, yes, yes. And further to the pioneering stuff, we had the first national Labor government in the world, which was Australia's Chris Watson government of 1904. That lasted a bit longer than a week. That was 4 months. And then in 1910, we had the first national Labor government in the world with a majority in both houses of parliament that could seriously go about introducing change, which the Fisher government did.
So there was this progressive young nation to your mind,
yes.
And it wasn't quite the same.
Never the same afterwards. No, and the other point is we had, such was the pioneering visionary nature of where we were, where it was seen outside Australia, that where we were heading, that we had all sorts of visitors from Europe crossing the globe to check out this advanced social laboratory for themselves. And that's a remarkable thing that's completely lost sight of today. And after World War One, they weren't coming anymore.
The great story in your book is you found these 10 men, these outstanding, extraordinarily talented 10 men who were lost. But they've been dead for nearly a century, and records have been lost, memories, of course, lost to it. How did you uncover their stories? This is a titanic feat of research, Ross.
Thank you, Richard. It was a big job. It was a big job. It felt at times like it was 10 different biographies happening simultaneously, which in a sense it is, even though the end result is that one is 50 pages and one is 60 and another one is 90 or something. But it was a hard part of research.
So what were your sources? How did you track down these letters? Are they in the keeping of the War Memorial, or where did you find them?
All over, yeah. But War Memorial is obviously a key source. The bibliography lists where they all came from. But it's part of the. I like the detective part of being a historian, and there was a lot of unearthing involved here.
Yeah, I just wonder if you had a sense of dread with some of these things, because you're reading these letters with something that the writer and recipient didn't have, which is hindsight.
Yes.
You know what's coming.
Yes.
For the men who've written these letters. What's it like to you to read the actual letters of these men who are young and full of bright promise, except you know what's coming?
Yes, that is very hard. And that, of course, applies to other work I've done, as you touched on, Richard. A lot of Pompey Elliott's men, when I wrote the book on Pompey Elliott, are in this category, so it's not just this project. But you do have a sense. Bill Gammage is another one who's commented on this. You go through the series of letters, you get to know the person, and you feel that they have so much to offer, and that you relate to them well, almost on a personal basis yourself, and then all of a sudden you reach the last one. And that's that.
Where does the title come from, Farewell, Dear People?
Farewell, Dear People comes from a letter that Jeff McRae wrote home to his family. Now, this is the Battle of Fromelles.
Yeah, I've got the quote here, actually. It says, today I lead my battalion in an assault on the German lines, and I pray to God I may come through all right and bring honour to our name.
Yes.
If not, I will at least have laid down my life for you and my country, which is the greatest privilege one can ask for. Farewell, dear people, the hour approacheth.
That's right. Now he wrote that on the day of the Battle of Fromelles, which is the worst day in Australian history.
Why do you say that?
We lost, in a completely fatuous operation, Australia lost 5,533 casualties in one night. Now, and Jeff McRae was one of them. Now, at the time he wrote that letter, he'd been so frantically busy trying to get ready for this operation that he'd hardly had a chance in recent days to write to his family. And this was on the day of the battle. He snatched a couple of moments and dashed that off.
You describe him, Jeff McRae, as... and you've got a picture of him in there. He's an incredibly handsome man, like he's movie star handsome, isn't he?
I mean, very, very handsome.
You know, you and I wish, you know, that
exactly.
This was the guy. You call him the great all-rounder.
Yes.
Why the all-rounder? What were some of his great talents?
Oh, he could have found a niche in all sorts of places, but he was descended from Melbourne's best-known creative dynasty, the McRaes. All sorts of relatives were active in all sorts of creative pursuits, writers, artists, cartoonists, poets, and he had the family's creative flair in writing and drawing, sketching, as well as he was a budding architect, and he was very keen on matters military and naval. He could have ended up in the military or the navy. And he died as a very young battalion commander, aged only 26, at Fromelles.
He had a particularly winning personality. I mean, and this is attested to by the lovely letters and things that people said about him before he died, as well as after he died. What was his relationship with his father like, in particular?
They were very close, and he was the youngest in the family. So George was quite old when Jeff was born, and when Jeff died, George was in his 80s and had led a large and full and fulfilling life, creatively and in other ways in the public service in Victoria. And George spent much of the rest of his life commemorating Jeff in all sorts of ways. It was the big thing in his life, really.
You got his brother writing years after the fact, that he's, one of the memories he has of Jeff is just sitting quietly holding hands with his dad.
That's right. That's right. And so this is Hugh McRae, who was a well-known poet and cartoonist, and he and Jeff were many years apart in the family. And Hugh moved to Sydney, and so he didn't see much of Jeff. But as you say, his memory of young Jeff was with the fingers intertwined with his dad, and he carried with him for ages.
You say they were a very creative family, but they weren't bohemians, were they? In fact, there's something kind of maddeningly wholesome about Jeff McRae. He's kind of Dudley Do-Right, isn't he?
He is that guy. Now, it should be pointed out, Hugh was an exception to that. Yeah. And that's partly why he goes to Sydney. But Jeff had the creative instincts, but he was a... driven by duty, straight. And as long as this ghastly war continued, he felt it was his role to persist in it.
He joined up after the outbreak of war, and
very early, straight away.
And he'd already been training anyway under Pompey Elliott, the great Australian officer.
Yes,
and arrived in Egypt like so many soldiers did. How did this nice, well-bred, wholesome young man take to sinful Cairo? How did he take to the delights of Cairo?
Not well. Like a few of his comrades, he thought some of this stuff was outrageous, some of the conduct. Pompey was the same, mind you. And he wrote home with great disgust about the sort of goings-on that were happening there and the fact that some of his men had been caught up in it.
Was he a wowser, do you think? Was that a bit too strong?
No, I wouldn't say he was a wowser. No, another thing about him is that, as you rightly said, he was stunningly attractive. Now, attractive women were attracted to Jeff, but he only had eyes for one by 1914, and this was Maud. And he wrote longingly and devotedly about Maud throughout the war, throughout his war.
What kind of things would he say about that?
Even things like, just dashed off a diary note at one point where he said, "I feel very weary, but do not sleep, and long for the touch of a vanished hand."
He was sent to Gallipoli, and it's amazing he survived the Gallipoli campaign.
Mm. Mm.
Tell me some of the things that he met with during the course of the Gallipoli campaign. He was there kind of right for some of its most dramatic moments.
He was... all set to participate in the landing when Pompey Elliott, possibly it was Pompey Elliott who directed him. Anyway, there was a change and he became a transport officer on another ship. And so he didn't land on the original Anzac Day, but he went ashore in May, and his battalion in the meantime had gone down to Helles. So he was without them for a while and he got wounded straight away. And he was taken off Gallipoli, got a bullet in the arm. And then he got that fixed up, came back in June, and then a lot of people think that there wasn't much artillery at Gallipoli, but the 7th Battalion, Jeff's battalion, their ordeal at Steele's Post in July under repeated artillery bombardments was quite severe and very harrowing.
It drove people insane, didn't it?
Drove people insane, yeah. And Jeff... Jeff was commended by Pompey Elliott for his stickability as an intelligence officer, just to stay on the front line as the shells are all raining down, and Jeff's doing the right, doing his duty as he sees it, thinking of Maud, thinking that this image of Maud comes into his face. He writes home and he says, I'm hanging in there, thinking of Maud, which has helped me to endure this. But in the end, the shell did blow up right near him, and he got some nasty face wounds and was taken off Gallipoli as a result.
Eventually, the Gallipoli campaign came to an end, and he recovered and got sick again and then got sent to France.
There's another little bit about Gallipoli. He happened to be involved in the at the evacuation where a couple of young blokes from Mooney Ponds in Melbourne invented the drip rifle, and he knew them. And he, in fact, passed it on to their heads, and that was part of the evacuation.
So the drip into the billy can, which triggered the rifle,
which enabled the rifle to fire after our blokes had gone.
And our guys evacuated successfully.
Yes, it contributed to it. Yes.
So then he goes to France, and he's working under Pompey Elliott. and the attack in the Fromelles sector was being planned, this worst 24 hours in Australian history. How did Pompey Elliott see the plans, the planned attack? What was his view of that attack?
Well, his view was that even though he'd been there only 5 minutes, that this was a disaster waiting to happen. And when someone from Haig's headquarters came down to check how the preparations were going, Pompey hijacked him, took him out to the front line, and then took him out beyond the front line into a trench out of no man's land and said, well, here are my orders, here are my dispositions, what do you think's going to happen here? And the bloke said, I think it's going to be a bloody Holocaust. And so Pompey said, well, if you think that way, you go back to Haig and tell him. And the operation, the planned operation, was delayed, postponed for a couple of days, a bit to do with weather and a bit to do with, I think, reconsideration at the highest levels, part because of Pompey's influence, because of what he said to this major from Haig's HQ. But it ended up, the delusions of Lieutenant General Haking persisted and triumphed in the end, and the operation went ahead, and as Pompey feared and predicted, it was an absolute disaster.
Could Geoff McRae see how murderous it was going to be before the campaign started?
Possibly. I don't know of that for sure, but...
Was he preparing for death?
The essence of it is that it wouldn't have mattered whether he did or he didn't, because he was primed to do his duty, and that meant leading his battalion forward as in accord with the letter we just read.
So, yeah, there was the letter we quoted from there where he said, at least I will have lain down my life for you and my country, which is the greatest privilege one can ask for. He's writing as though his parents want him to lay down his life.
Well, I think the wording of that letter partly answers the question you just asked a minute ago. There is a sense there, isn't there, of that he's sensing that things might not go too well.
But did his family want him to lay down his life for his country?
Clearly not. I mean, there's this disconnect here that he sees himself as doing brave things and all the stickability and perseverance for them, and he gets the image of Maud to assist him to do it, but back home, all they want him to do is survive, and they live in perpetual dread of the. Of the cable.
How did he meet his end?
Well, he precisely, as the letter predicted, he led his men forward on the day of the battle, and he was out in no man's land, kneeled down at one point to check directions or supervise what was going on or something, and he was shot at that time, and he stayed kneeling.
He shot the neck, and yep. He stayed...
Stayed kneeling.
Stayed kneeling.
In that kneeling position, yes.
Was his body retrieved?
Eventually, yes. Yes, he was buried behind the lines, yes.
And the effect of his death on his family?
Effect of his death, utterly devastating.
His dad?
His dad, as I said, spent much of the rest of his long life commemorating Geoff in all sorts of ways. He wrote poignant verse, he had a window installed at their local church. He persevered in trying to get Geoff retrospective honours. It did a host of things for over a decade.
After the attack, Lieutenant General Richard Haking, who insisted that the attack go ahead, and insisting that the attackers would have the advantage because they would have Elan or whatever it was that they thought
they
had.
Yes,
he summed up the outcome and said, I think that the attack, though it failed, has done both divisions a great deal of good.
Yes, he's referring there to the Australian division and the English division alongside that was also cut up.
They were almost destroyed.
It's an extraordinary comment. It's extraordinary comment or justification. I mean, here we have, it's the worst day in Australian history. 5,500 Australians become casualties in one night. This bloke's directed the show, urged that it happen, and then he writes something of that extraordinary fatuousness afterwards.
There almost was no division, was there? I mean, it had almost been destroyed.
True. The 5th Division was in no shape for effective performance for months and months.
I'm with historian Ross McMullen at the moment, the author of Farewell, Dear People, Biographies of Australia's Lost Generation. Let's talk about another one who was a real loss to the world, Clunes Matheson. Clunes Matheson, brilliant medical researcher. He was an all-rounder at Caulfield Grammar, chose medicine. How did he perform in his medical career to begin with?
He did brilliantly at university. He was a very successful student. He won honours, scholarships, and everything you could win, really. But he wasn't a sort of just an isolated swat sort of a student. He involved himself in a lot of other things. He was active in the Melbourne University Medical Students Association.
He was very keen on medical research and he wanted to wed clinical research to patient outcomes, which is
exactly right. But he wasn't just a what's the word? He wasn't just a nerd. No. He was involved. He represented the university at football and cricket and so on. But then what he wanted to do, as you say, was to involve himself in medical research.
Can you speculate on what personal reasons he might have had for immersing himself in medical research?
Part of the genealogical research involved with Matheson was uncovering what happened to his siblings. His mother gave birth to six siblings. Only Clunes survived to the age of 10. And his father as well died agonisingly of peritonitis while Clunes was 12. Now, that was presumably an undiagnosed case of appendicitis, which for GPs at the time wasn't all that straightforward to pinpoint. So Clunes had a lot of death
seven,
to live with.
Seven family funerals he grew up with.
Not exactly that, but some of them died before he was born, or something. But there was a lot of death in his family as he grew up, and it's an irresistible conclusion that for an extremely talented man like Clunes, who had genuine interests across the humanities as well as the sciences, and could have pursued all sorts of things, opted to go down the path of medical science and medical research. He at one point a friend of his who later became acting Prime Minister, John Latham, suggested that Matthew, which is what he was known by all his friends, that Matthew should have a crack at a Rhodes Scholarship. And he said, "No, I don't want to do any more study. I want to get my teeth into serious research." And he went overseas to do just that in 1908 and found success very, very quickly. He won a scholarship to study with one of the world's most eminent men, Professor Starling, and also worked at the Lister Institute, which was headed then by Professor Charles Martin, also a world-renowned leader. And what they said about Matheson was extraordinary. Martin said, "No man I have ever known possesses the genius for research so highly as Matheson. He always seems to know by instinct the essential difficulties of a problem and how to tackle them." And Starling, after his death, said that Matheson arrived in London with the reputation of being the best graduate who'd ever come out of Melbourne University Medical School. And he not only maintained this reputation in England, but added to it, producing a massive original work of the highest importance that was published in a rapid succession of masterly papers. And he went on to say that, which is an extraordinary accolade, in my view, that after Matheson died, he wrote that the loss of Matheson represented to the science of medicine throughout the world that was irreparable, throughout the world.
How was he drawn into the war? What kind of service did he begin with?
He had participated in militia service, just like McRae, in a different area as a medico, and in a field ambulance unit. And when the war broke out, just like Jeff McRae, Clunes Matheson enlisted straight away, and he was as a doctor, and he was in the second field ambulance. But left with the first convoy and trained in Egypt. But then, just in the final preparations before the Gallipoli landing, in the week before, there was a late switch. Someone had a bad fall and fractured his skull, a doctor, and Matheson was switched from the 2nd Field Ambulance to the 5th Battalion as their doctor.
Plans were afoot for this cancer institute in Melbourne that he was supposed to head up.
Indeed. So the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute happened to be finally established at the very time when Clunes was switched from the field ambulance unit that he was in to become the 5th Battalion doctor. And so that meant that he went into action with the battalion on the day of the landing. He had been appointed the inaugural director of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, although he never knew this. Then a fortnight after the landing, the 5th Battalion was transferred down to Krithia. They had this charge, which was another insane event, really. He died as a result of that, having performed outstandingly as a medico beforehand.
He was shot in broad in a charge that was taking place in broad daylight.
The aftermath of it, he'd gone back to his aid post a bit to the rear, but in essence the action that he was involved in was a remarkable one, that the Australians were rushed into action, were given preposterously short notice. Given half an hour's notice and told that they had to advance 3 miles across an open plain in broad daylight towards Turkish machine gunners and sharpshooters who had demolished a series of similar attacks that had not succeeded in attaining one-sixth of the distance.
So he was shot in the afternoon at his post putting his boots on. Shot, just like that.
A bullet that wasn't even aimed at him, that just an ultra-long-range bullet, which just among those that were floating down the creek, happened to hit him as he was pulling his boots on. And this was... And the result was that a precious genius who had an enormous future in Australia and was enormously significant to Australia's future was lost in this ridiculous operation.
It was a medical lecture that was named after him, and that's still going today, though, isn't it?
It is.
The Matheson lecture.
It is. Yes, it was set up by a friend of his who gathered the money to fund it, and it was for triennial lectures in medical science.
I'm also conscious of the fact that you said earlier all of his other siblings had died, and now him. So his mother was left with no one.
Yes.
No one at all.
No one at all. No one at all. And... she wrote some very poignant letters about that.
That was the loss of Clunes Matheson. Then we come to Robert Beige. Beige or Beige?
Beige.
Beige. Nothing beige about this guy, though. There's a picture of him in your book, and he's got this kind of close-cropped hair and a beard. I suppose he's in Antarctica. He's got a kind of... he's genially smoking this great big sort of ornate German pipe. What kind of personality did Robert Beige have?
He was a practical, reliable, unflappable sort of a guy, who at the same time had an adventurous temperament, and he very much wanted to join Mawson's party, and he performed very, very well while he was there. That photo was taken by Frank Hurley of Beige as he was coming back to Australia from Antarctica, having been there 2 years and 3 months.
Mawson rated him really highly on that expedition, didn't he?
He did, and Mawson was inclined to be quite critical at times of various other members of the expeditionary party, but his diaries contained no criticism of Beige. And when Mawson at times was away from the hut, away from the main base, Beige was one of the senior men left in either command or close to it.
Now, this is in the days of the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, as it's called, but pre-World War One, when there is no, you know, plastic all-weather gear, there's no... snowmobiles.
There's nothing.
Yeah, they had dogs and sleds and a ramshackle hut to live in, and going out and about. He's the scientific work that he did seems really quite heroic. He was, you know, you write, he was an astronomer, the assistant magnetician, because they went to the magnetic pole, and recorder of the tides, coastline, all those kind of things.
Mawson was very much a scientific explorer. I mean, he he wasn't too keen on the idea of racing somewhere to plonk a flag there just for the sake of being the first
one. Yeah, like Scott of the Antarctic,
It's the name that springs to mind. Yeah, but he wasn't the only one. And so Mawson wasn't too keen on that. And Mawson wanted the focus to be on scientific exploration and the gathering of important records in this stretch of Antarctica where they were, 2,000 miles stretch of Antarctica where no human had been before. And it also happened to be where they built their hut. It turned out to be the windiest place on the planet. Mawson,
a bit chilly there too, just quietly as well.
Just quietly, a bit chilly. Yes, and Mawson envisaged that the main part of the climax for him of the expedition would be when they would finally be able to get out of the hut after this apocalyptic weather they'd had to endure, and they could then go out and do various sledging expeditions. Now, he went off with two comrades and the dogs, all the dogs, and to the east, and all of the sledging expeditions were coastal, except for Beige's, the one that Beige led with Frank Hurley and a magnetician named Eric Webb from New Zealand, and they travelled on their own, hauling this massive sledge uphill over rough terrain. Most of the time they couldn't see it because of the way the visibility was.
He got terrible snow blindness.
He got snow blindness.
Had to have his eyes bandaged.
When the sun did come out, they got snow blindness, and Beige had a bad case of it, which one of his comrades described as being like, it's as if you got nasty gravel in your eyes, sharp gravel in your eyes, is what it felt like. And there were times, yes, when he had to go on the sledge and be hauled by the other two with both his eyes bandaged. And in the end, they went 300 miles south, and then the homeward journey, they had stashes of food at different places to retrieve, and they couldn't find the last one. And there were 67 miles from the main hut. The three of them, they'd without that stash, they had practically no food, and they eventually, after days of trying to find it, they couldn't find it, and they were weak. They were tremendously hungry. They had incipient scurvy, and eventually decided to make a bold dash for it because they couldn't find the stash, the final stash. And matter of life and death, Webb wrote in his diary.
Hurley, they had to race against hunger, didn't they?
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Hurley wrote something like, "My comrades are fine men and breathe no pessimism." It was a terrible couple of days that they had, that final trek home, but they got there. And as a matter of importance, they, in deciding what they would shed, they shed absolutely everything except the records, except these meteorological records that they had meticulously obtained, meteorological, magnetic, and all the rest of
it. They were scientists.
Yeah, scientific explorer.
So he survives Antarctica and then joins up and is sent to Gallipoli.
Yes.
How did he receive his fatal assignment in Gallipoli?
Again, this was within the first fortnight at Gallipoli. It's May the 7th, and he was out doing what had been doing a series of things that engineers do. On this particular day, he'd spent the morning surveying, and he came wandering down a trench, perhaps with a bit of lunch in mind, and he happened to encounter the Major General commanding the 1st Australian Division, General Bridges, who greeted him with delight and said, "Here's the man!"
Well, he just was walking past at the wrong time.
Walking past the wrong point, the wrong time. And Bridges said, "Here's the man!" And Beige was a bit startled, because it wasn't every day he was greeted like that by the Major General of the 1st Australian Division, but then he found out why he was the man, and he became genuinely concerned, because what Bridges had decided was that a reliable engineer, which was a category that Beige clearly filled, a reliable engineer was needed to go out and mark by hammering some pegs in front of the Australian line, 150 yards in front of the then Australian line, the spot where Bridges wanted advance to take place imminently. Now, Beige said, well, that's a very risky assignment, sir. I think it'd be far more likely to be effectively done at night. And Bridges said, no. And he was adamant. And he said, it's got to be done this afternoon. So what Beige was effectively doing was going out 150 yards in front of the Australian line and hammering in some marker pegs in full view of the Turks in broad daylight.
It's a bit like, I was saying this earlier, Blackadder, isn't it? You know, where General Melchett wants his drinks cabinet moved 6 inches closer to Berlin? Isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like that, isn't it?
It was widely
said. Go out there into the middle of, what, no man's land, is it? Or to a position.
Yes.
And hammer in some pegs.
Hammer in some pegs. That's right. And so Beige, being an astute person as well as a loyal officer, said, OK, well, I've got to do this, and the writing's on the wall. And he said he didn't expect it to survive it to those close to him, and arranged for the dispersal of his belongings, being the reliable, methodical, organised chap that he was, and then went out and did his utmost to do it, and was shot to pieces by a fusillade from the Turks, umpteen infantrymen, and at least 5 machine guns.
This is the bravest man on Douglas Mawson's expedition. Shot to pieces.
He was outstanding at Mawson's expedition, and his life was thrown away cavalierly by Bridges. And the point here, Richard, is we often, as Australians, condemn the way people like Haking at Fromelles and General Hunter Weston at Helles in the action that led to Matheson's death, condemn the way British generals threw away Australian lives, but it wasn't just British generals who were throwing them away.
This was an Australian general.
Bridges was an Australian.
Finally, can we talk about this is by no means all the men in the book, but there's a group of 3 West Australians you've got in your book there, which really struck me, their stories. 2 brothers, Gresley Harper and Wilfred Harper. What names, too? And Phipps Turnbull. I'll just say those names again. Gresley Harper, Wilfred Harper, Phipps Turnbull. You don't see names like that anymore in this day and age, do you?
No. And the Harpers had other brothers. There was a Harcourt and a Prescott Harper.
Of course there was. Yes. These were all brilliant young men from the 10th Light Horse. Yes, the 10th Light Horse in West Australia, which was tiny in those days, that colony. It had so few, I don't know, what, 30,000 people or something like that? A tiny amount of people.
Yes, as they were growing up, or perhaps even a touch before that, the population of West Australia was very much less than Tasmania, which is inconceivable.
Yeah,
now.
I know. Yeah, and they came from some of the best families of WA. Relations who were premiers and senior legal figures. And it's these 2 brothers and Phipps Turnbull. There's some lovely stories about these men, and they're really quite sweet. They were sent as part of the 10th Light Horse to Gallipoli without their horses, because it turned out there was not much of a need for their horses, or that was seen at the time. And while they were there, they were sent in essentially as infantry, really, then, weren't they? There's a lovely story you've got in your book about how Gresley Harper was with his friend Bob Lucan, and they saw a batch of Turkish prisoners being led past. Tell that story of what happened there.
Yes, they were just below Quinn's Post, and in fact there was an action underway, and they were expected to be called on any minute to participate in themselves. But while they were waiting there, as you say, Richard, this group of Turkish prisoners filed past, and Gresley was struck in observing them, how the different characteristics of them were. There was a fatalistic sort of approach by some, and others were very much on edge, expecting to be killed any minute, having been captured. And when Bob Lucan offered a bit of biscuit to one of these Turkish prisoners, the Turk broke down in tears of gratitude.
It's lovely, isn't it? Touched his arm. This was an older guy too, wasn't it?
Yes.
An older prisoner of war.
Yes.
And then there's another story about a Turkish prisoner.
There is another story about a Turkish prisoner involving Gresley. Now, this is still up at Quinn's, where this is the most vulnerable acme of the Australian position, and it's a very fluid and dangerous spot to be in. And the 10th Light Horse were there early in, soon after their arrival at Gallipoli, and at one point the seniors on the spot noticed that the Turks had established a position closer towards the Australians than had been the case before. and then they vacated, they created a crater with an explosion, and it was decided that the Australians had to occupy this crater, and the 10th Light Horse were directed to do it, and the Australians attacked, the 10th Light Horse attacked, Gresley was part of them, they duly captured the crater.
Which was an amazing feat all on its own, wasn't it?
Amazing, just dashing across the crest at Quinns.
But the problem is once you're in a quiet crater,
you're in a crater. Yeah. You're absolutely, yes. But what happened was they dealt with or
dispatched.
Killed,
in fact, yes.
Yes, the other word I was looking for was to cover Turks that escaped.
Right.
Yeah, so they killed some, and others escaped, but one didn't. And he was wounded and couldn't get away, this Turk. And they ended up, the Australians for the 10th Light Horsemen crammed into this crater, and in effect they'd imprisoned themselves.
Yeah, they were there for hours, weren't they?
They were there at a very hot afternoon for a long, long time with this single Turk.
With a Turkish prisoner. And there's like bullets and munitions, there's bombs landing in the crater?
They realised they were within range of the Turkish trenches at Quinns, and the Turks, who had a lot more bombs than the Australians, were deluging the crater with bombs, and the Australians, particularly the ones who'd played a bit of cricket, as Gresley had, were catching them and throwing them back before they exploded.
My God!
And
what else can you do? I mean, what else can you do? Pick up a bomb and to lob it back again.
Lob it back again. And at one point, they realised that there was nothing much more they could do other than vacate, which was a decision that was accelerated because the Turks were seen to be coming at them. So they left, and before they left in those hours of occupation, Grez befriended the wounded Turk in the crater.
What did he do for him?
He gave him food, and they shared food.
Dressed his wounds too, didn't he?
Fixed him up. Yep, and the prisoner in fact gave some Turkish bread to the Australian Light Horse officer who was in charge of the crater at that point, and he didn't find it all that palatable, it was said at the time. But the key thing is that Grez befriended the Turk, and when the Australians saw Turks coming towards them in the crater, they had to suddenly make the same kind of mad dash back to their lines that they'd made to get to the crater in the first place. The idea was to take the Turk back, but that turned out not to be possible in the panic and the mad scramble. But one of the Australians slipped on the edge of the trench and the edge of the crater and fell back in. And the Turks, oncoming, surrounded this bloke. The three Turks came towards him, and he was all set to be a goner. And the Turk, the prisoner who had been befriended by Grez and the others in the crater, shot his own countryman. In other words, in effect, this Turk who had been befriended by Grez in the crater had swapped sides in this brief skirmish.
He shot his own people
to enable that 10th Light Horseman who'd slipped on the edge of the crater and had fallen back into the crater to escape.
And did he escape?
He did escape.
And what happened to the Turkish prisoner?
He was shot straight away, as he knew he would be.
Then took part in the Battle of the Neck, Gresley and his brother Wilfred
and Phipps
Turnbull. And we know this story for anyone who's seen the movie Gallipoli. Mm. We know what happens there. The first, poorly conceived, once again, the first charge over the top, everyone gets mowed down, many of them before they can even fully get out of the trench. Second charge, they all get mowed down.
They are Victorian members of the 8th Light Horse. And then the third and fourth lines were scheduled to be the West Australians.
And that included Gresley, his brother Wilfred, and Phipps Turnbull. Mm. They could see what was happening. We know the story of the officer that ran back to headquarters to ask that the attack be cancelled, and he said, "No, man, stick to it. We're gonna go ahead."
Mm.
And when he came back with the bad news, how did these men in the Light Horse then greet the news? How did they prepare for what they must have known must be their inevitable death?
Yes. Well, these moments are what makes this event so poignant, is that they knew what was coming and they prepared themselves for it. They turned to each other and embraced or said all the best or what you could imagine them doing in those circumstances. One bloke turned to the chap alongside him and said, "God bless you, Cobber," And that ended up on his headstone, which is there as his last words. And then as well, as there's been a book that's been published since with that as the title of the book. We should mention here as well, as I don't think we have, Phipps Turnbull was the fourth West Australian Rhodes Scholar, an exceptionally talented bloke with an assured future in law and or politics, went over to Oxford on his scholarship, won a first-class honours degree in jurisprudence. 60 students were awarded honours. Only three were awarded firsts, and he was one from the back blocks of WA.
The whistleblowers
charge over the top.
And it was Wolf's idea to... It was his idea just to run as fast as he could towards the Turkish positions.
Yes, yes.
And he's the guy that inspired Peter Weir to...
That inspired Peter Weir. And Peter Weir has been, if we throw forward to the 1970s, 80s, Peter Weir has been grappling with this idea of a great project on Gallipoli for years. He's been to Gallipoli, he's gone through the trenches, he's read all these accounts, and he just can't find a way of telling the story that works for him. And then all of a sudden he goes back to Bean and he's reading about the charge of the neck. And he reads this one sentence about Wilfred, a chap who was last seen running forward like a schoolboy in a foot race with all the speed he could muster. And he said, aha, that's the motive for my film. That's it. Now, Wilf became the motive for the film, and he has in common with the character Archie Hamilton, played by Mark Lee, the manner of death. But it shouldn't be assumed that the Mark Lee Archie Hamilton character in the film is Wilfred.
No, they're similar, but they're
inspired on the other. It's the manner of death.
So yeah. Phipps Turnbull is shot even as he's trying to scramble out of the trench, yes. Shot and killed.
Yes.
And Wilf and Gresley, they...
Well, it's not...
It's not clear
what happened to Gresley, but it's possible that he ran forward as well, as fast as he could as well. But unfortunately, not enough witnesses survived just to know what Gresley did.
And that the great young men of WA, that small colony, wiped out in that charge. So there's the stories. When you were writing these stories of these men who were. His lives were, it has to be said, in many cases, just frittered away in pointless actions by men who fancied that they were common sense, generals of common sense, were in fact just unimaginative, blinkered and stupid. Did you write it more in sorrow or in anger, writing these stories, Ross?
Sorrow more than anger, I think. Yeah, sorrow more than anger. Just the effect that it clearly had on Australia. So that's a matter of sorrow rather than anger for me.
Did people notice the change in Australia? Did they feel the great sense, an absence of? It's hard to feel what you don't know you were ever going to have. But
yes, I mean that's an interesting question. I think there are glimpses that these sort of differences were perceived. Norman Lindsay once. Once wrote that hearty, uninhibited laughter was very evident before 1914, and it largely disappeared after 1919. And someone in England thought and wrote the same thing.
And finally, Ross, you've got in your book a letter written by Geoffrey McRae, who was the soldier we talked about earlier on, who could write very beautifully at times about what he was seeing. And rather than ask you to read something about the horror of war, I'd like to read a part where he talks about, he's writing from a letter written in Egypt, describing the kind of night falling on the encampment. Could you read that for us, please?
Yeah, sure, Richard. It is beautiful passing below Mena House in the evening. The heat and the sandstorms subside, and a beautiful cool calm reigns beneath the glorious star-lit Egyptian sky. The air is laden with the most beautiful perfume, for the orange groves are in full blossom. Soldiers come and go in their sombre khaki like phantoms in the gloom. In the background, amidst the dim lights of the camp, stand out the brilliant electrically lit fronts of the cinemas like bright jewels set in dull gold. From out of the darkness, here and there comes the jingle of harness and clink of accoutrements. Down Camp Valley floats the strains of martial music from a band in the lines. Then crashes out on the still desert air the clarion notes of the last post, sounded by the massed buglers. The men grow fewer on the road, and then come the long drawn-out notes of lights out. The lights of camp disappear like a lot of smouldering embers upon which water has been thrown suddenly, save the red and green lights and the red lights hanging on the staffs over divisional and brigade headquarters. The road becomes deserted, except for the sentries in their watch coats moving to and fro near huge black masses of heaped-up fodder bags. Peace and quietness broods over Australia's thousand sons who await that awful hour when they will be called upon to go forth to destroy or be destroyed. And it is then that we realise how much we have sacrificed, and a feeling of bitterness comes over to us when we think of all those who might have come, yet still hang back and partake of the joy of being near their loved ones, a happiness which has long since been denied us, its place having been taken by a yearning for those glorious days which may never dawn again for many of us. True it is that absence makes the heart grow fonder. Au revoir.
Ross McMullen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.